Вот, Пакавато, Намо тасса Пакавато, Намо тасса Пакавато, Арахато, Сама, Самбуддхасса. Буддхаң Даммаң Сангхаң Намассамин. The full moon of August, the one month of the Vasa, has passed. 2 months to go in the Vasa. And I'm quite pleased with the way things are going here. We came together this Vasa. Many of us hadn't, most of us hadn't really lived together. We knew four new, three and a half new bhikkhus. And for a group of men to come together and live under this kind of discipline and live in harmony is actually quite commendable, I think. Not that I want to brag, but all of you have strong opinions. You're not wimpy in any way. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have strong sense of purpose. And each of us has our different personalities, cultural interpretations of this life, our own familial karma, different ages, different life experiences that we bring to this. And men can be very willful. They can they actually fight sometimes. They do things like argue and punch each other in the face and do all manner of unfortunate things. So for a group of men who have strong intentions to live in harmony is it's a very, I think, inspiring thing. And yet not to be just clones or obsequious sycophants. Sometimes somebody used to call it obsequious sycophants. So to actually have strength of character, strength of purpose, but also live with some sense of self-sacrifice, some sense of giving up one's own position taking, giving up one's preferences for the sake of giving up as much as anything else, and also for the sake of communal harmony. These are very commendable things, very, very good things. So we've lived together for the first month of the Vasa. The disagreements that we've had have been minor. We've managed to talk them through. We have a good agreement about the Vinaya. We're studying the Vinaya in the mornings. How we want to, how we interpret these rules from the Vinaya and from our forest tradition. And so we, because we are able to do this in a quite a, I think, at least from my perspective, a very harmonious way. That gives us a lot of space for our own inner contemplations, for looking at our own hang-ups and the way our minds experience suffering or the end of suffering. And if we were caught up in endless argumentation and position-taking and exercising of testosterone will and trying to dominate each other, political angling to get the resources that one wanted, all the rest of it, then of course we'd never have time for our own inner reflections. So we're very fortunate in that way. I think we're very fortunate to, first of all, have the good karma to be doing this. I'm not saying we're all perfect, you know. We're all working on it, but just to figure that the good karma we have, that we are able to pull this life off. Bunch of Westerners, one Thai, one Burmese, different nationalities, different upbringings. So, and this is good. This sets a very good example to the lay people. to our supporters, because nothing is more disheartening than to see a sangha which isn't diligent, isn't practicing, is caught up in political argumentation or ego strutting. And so I think we honor the dana that we are given, the support of the lay people, by living in harmony and doing our best to support each other. This is good. I think this is something that is commendable. So whatever is going down, like individually in your own hearts and minds, sometimes the inner practice might not seem like it's getting anywhere. Sometimes it does. Maybe you think your samadhi's not quite up to scratch or whatever. But do remember this, just this very effort for a group of men to live together like this is practice. It's good. It's good to be doing this. Because it requires a certain amount of self-sacrifice. It requires a certain amount of sensitivity to each other, doesn't it? I have to listen. You have to listen. Try to fathom where the other person's at. And that's the kind of methodology of our part of the methodology of our spiritual life, is that by practicing self-sacrifice, practicing generosity with each other, through just listening and trying to hear another person's viewpoint, trying to consider their maybe cultural background, the defilements they're struggling with, and all of that, having the metta and upeka to listen, and yet allow a person to go through the difficulties and yet live within the vinaya. That's the methodology of the heart, I think. It's just to have the rules, to have an agreement about the rules without that sensitivity to each other and without that capacity to listen and accept other viewpoints, to find, to disagree, but not to dominate, not to hurt each other. This is the practice of forgiveness and open-heartedness and upekkha. These are very good qualities. And so we don't have to you don't necessarily have to develop those qualities in a very deliberate way. Just the fact that one's willing to listen to someone else and just try to see, where are you at? How are you doing with this? It's already metta bhavana in a very practical way, because one's willing to allow this other person into your mind. Position taking and dominating others or trying to manipulate others and all that, that's always a very egotistical and unskillful way to live, and leads to not developing paramita. So just see that the capacity to listen patiently to another viewpoint and allow a person to actually just follow through theirs, and then listen and say, okay, you see it that way, and then, but I see it this way, and to be able to dialogue something isn't necessarily about coming to an agreement. It's just learning to live together as human beings, as compassionate human beings. So the way that I was taught through Wat Pho Phong was that one had both solitary practice, and also we had quite a lot of communal activity. And quite often, solitary practice, some people like it, some don't. People who like the solitary practice quite often will ask in a monastery, I want more solitary practice. But often that's just because they don't like people. And that's a good one to watch. Or why do I maybe prefer solitary practice? Well, it's basically I don't really like humans. I don't like human interaction. I don't like the friction of it. It's messy. I just like the silence of my own kuti, reading my own books and doing things my way. So that is challenged through community life, where just the need to sit in a group and listen to different viewpoints, which might take quite a considerable amount of time. Let's just get on with this. But there's a quality of mind that is possible to develop, and that's a patience, compassion, listening, trying to fathom where the other person's at. And then the person who is very communal, of course, then sometimes they find difficulty being alone, being in the kuti, developing those times of solitude, So that's also important, that to spend time, so like to try to spend an afternoon doing 3 or 4 hours of sitting, walking, which is our tradition. That has great power. And so this is the way I've learned monasticism, these two parts of our life, the solitary, the communal, and I think both have much to teach us, there's much to learn. So we chanted this today for Ajahn Yatiko, who might not be Ajahn Yatiko anymore. And that's for all of us, especially if you knew him, it's a sad thing to see a brother leave the road. But it's not, in no way is it wrong, in no way is it a failure. It is what it is. Then we might judge it. Each of us might judge it in a particular way, but that's our judgment. You don't really know. Our Sangha is much more mature than it was when we first started in England, because when in England we had our first disrobings of senior monks, it was quite very upsetting for the community in a way which some of the community didn't really react very skillfully. There was maybe a blaming or a lot of emotion, a lot of emotion around that, and that was just the nature of a young order learning how to process the very natural things of people coming and going. I think for the Thai people, Thailand, they've been doing monasticism for a long, long time, and there's a quite a common movement of men in and out of the order. So it's more the norm for us in those days, at least. It was like the first disrobings we had of senior people. It was very, very unsettling. So, of course, as you know, in Sri Lanka, there's a different cultural attitude to disrobing it than Thailand. So Thailand, the cultural attitude is that any amount of time in the robe is really very auspicious, very, very wholesome, very good thing to do. Sri Lanka, there's that too, but there's more an ethos of staying for a lifetime. So more like Christian monastic vows, where man undertakes to do that for a lifetime. And as we all know, the Vinaya says that one can leave the training anytime. So the way we put it is the way we talk about it, we pick up the training when we take Upasambada or Papaja, and then when we leave the order, we have ways that we do that properly, and then we leave. We put down the training, so we pick up the training, put down the training. So sometimes Christian ideas of guilt might come up. Christian ideas of failure, like divorce, they might, Western ideas that that's a failure in some way, but it's a change. It's a change. And why it's particularly painful, I think, is because if one is live this life with someone for a long period of time, as some of you have, you form a bond which is significant. It's very significant that you don't even realize may be happening, because you struggle together. One has arguments and difficulties, and one works them through. Common projects of extreme physical exertion and quiet retreats where one is struggling with bad knees and a recalcitrant mind, and through all that sort of inner struggle, communal struggle, there's also a lot of uplift, times of celebration, times of feeling, yeah, this is really a very important place and a significant place, and then lay people come and praise and offer thank you. So living together like that is very, very significant. You form a bond you don't even know you're forming, and then when that splits up, there's a strong sense of sadness, and the beauty of the Dhamma Vinaya is that our life is based upon allowing all these things to be as they are. So the sadness of separation, one knows that in the heart. Well, sadness is, that's separation from the loved ones, is suffering. And the recognition of that as a natural phenomena, as a natural occurrence, then there isn't a tendency to blame others, to project onto them ideas of failure or you know, kind of very unkind things like that. And then things change. Things change. So there's a sense of both equanimity and karuna, metta karuna for that kind of situation. So all of us, of course, wish Venerable Yatiko the very, 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 very best. Maybe he hasn't even disrobed. Maybe he'll change his mind in the last minute. I don't know. But the point of the way of liberation is, of course, to see that in the unstable and the unsure, that you need to keep recognizing that this is unstable, this is unsure. So when something happens like that, when there's a sense of loss, a sense of separation, to see, okay, that formation is unreliable. So friendships, we say, are unreliable, but they're not unreliable in terms of loyalty. They're unreliable in terms of reliability. People die, things change. We find ourselves disliking people. We like people. We dislike them. We find them inspiring. We find them boring. And so, the practice of the heart is one of seeing that the characteristics of a person are very unreliable. So if you feel inspired by someone, fine. If you feel negative towards them, fine. But to hold a position of negativity towards someone who's disrobed and then forever project onto them failure, it's not dhamma, it's ego. Or to hold a position about someone because of some disagreement or argument that we've had, to hold a position that this person is always that way, is not dhamma, it's a sense of self. And then vice versa, to think that people will somehow have some kind of duty to inspire me or make me happy or fulfill me or do what I want them to do is also fraught with danger. So our common accord, our common agreement is not based on kind of psychological intimacy or physical intimacy or emotional intimacy. That's not the way the Sangha is set up. It's based upon an aspiration to Nibbana, a willingness to live by the training, and a willingness to share the space so that others can also participate in that training. So a willingness towards self-sacrifice so that a place like this is suitable for others to use and possible. And that's different than like emotional intimacy. We don't, emotional intimacy or some kind of demand or hopefulness about some deeply connected friendship. Deeply connected friendships can happen, but they can also sour. I've seen that where two people in a big monastery would get very, very close and begin to kind of almost have a clique, but somehow get separated from the community, and then they have a falling out. It's quite very worldly. That's a very, very worldly way to operate. So what we're trying to have a sense of respect and friendship with it, and with all the members of the Sangha, all the laity, in a way which has metta karuna in it, but also has a certain amount of aloofness or upekā. And in our lifestyle is that we have this friendship, kalyana mitta, but also we have self-reliance, and that each of us has an opportunity and a responsibility to figure this out each for ourselves, to see for ourselves. So there isn't what, hopefully we're not, we're not developing kind of emotional dependencies with each other. I don't think we are at all. That's different than, so when we talk about like Kalyanamitta, it's not like emotional dependencies or emotional intimacy. It's like fellow practitioners who lead the way, who are friends through good example, who are friends through pointing out Dhamma rather than commiserating on misery. Say one can commiserate, but also to point out Dhamma and to uplift a person. This is Kalyanamitta. And so each of us, like today we came together and we chanted the Patimokkha. Venerable Chinda chanted the Patimokkha, very nicely done. And we each are, we're a mirror to each other, aren't we? And I think I've always found that when I come together for Patimokkha, I see, we have our full monastic regalia on. We have our sanghatis and our robes on. It's all very formal, very high church. And we do our acknowledgement of errors we've made in the practice. And that's, for me, it's always been a very powerful reminder of our noble undertaking, our noble aspiration. And that's one really beautiful thing we can offer to each other, is just good practice. Good practice in terms of being responsible in our duties, being responsible in taking care of the spaces in a way where we don't leave it to others to do. And then also taking care of our own practice, our own samatha practice, or our own study, and so that we can lead through example. That's very, very helpful. Very, very helpful, the right speech, right action. And then our community is, it has a kind of meaning which is not based on the usual ways of emotional intimacy and emotional dependence on others. It's different. It's a different kind of friendship. Doubts we might have about practice. Sometimes you can solve doubts through study, academic study. Sometimes you can solve doubts through conversation, asking a fellow practitioner, how do I do this? How do I get out of this? How do I practice this? But a lot of doubts are just solved through the hard graft of being on your cushion and watching the doubting mind, the unsure mind, the insecure mind, as conditions. Insecurity as a condition that arises and ceases. Doubt as a condition that arises and ceases. Disillusionment as a condition that arises and ceases. Disinterest as a condition that arises and ceases. All the modes of discontent. And as one patiently no longer demands that this life somehow be emotionally fulfilling, but that we can be with the emotional ups and downs, then awareness begins to have power, the awareness of change. The satisampajanya begins to be the dominant energy in consciousness rather than the dominant energy of loneliness seeking, distraction, of restlessness seeking or aversion seeking to project blame, fear running away from life in some kind of way. Now the refuge in mindfulness and clear comprehension, where awareness of change relating to things through Anicca Dukkha Anatta, that all that kind of talk and business and practice that we do begins to create a heart which is very, very content. And that contentment is no longer based on external things, no longer based on friendships, food, relationships, comfort, weather, interest, fascination. That contentment is one which is a liberated thing, because it's no longer dependent on conditions. So the capacity to endure, to patiently watch some difficult state of mind coming up and knowing it as anicca dukkha anatta creates the conditions for non-grasping. Or, you know, it really is what non-grasping is about. At the time, it might not seem like it's really working, so you endure some, one endures some kind of difficult, some form of lust or anger or fear, you know, manifests, and it seems so hopeless sometimes. And yet all the time, you know, letting the mind create a sense of self, constantly going, this is a sankhara, this is anicca dukkha anatta, that repeated practice of trust that relationship to that which is changing, of knowing change, is the doorway, and is the thing you have to really have faith and trust in. Because what happens is then the intensity of these Mara energies coming at us, that intensity falls away, and they're no longer problematic. They're not so threatening. They're not so real anymore. They still might come, but they don't have the power anymore to delude, because now sati sampajanya has a kind of dominant play, a dominant energy in this whole inner practice that we do. And then it's the unfolding of karma, of habits, of developing a more sustained capacity to not get deluded, not get caught by all of that. I think also, like with Venerable Yatiko, or any bhikkhu who's been in the life for so long, I think I certainly realize how lucky we are that we can do this, and that we somehow have the barmy to do this. Which isn't, I think, self-congratulatory, it's just realizing one's good fortune. And this is the way of our life, that rather than demanding happiness or comfort or the requisites in some particular way that we want, we begin to sense how rare this human birth is, how rare it is to be a samana, and to actually have the barmi to live this life. And then there's a sense of gratitude, rather than demanding and trying to manipulate the resources according to my own preferences. And so that gratitude and patience and metta karuna, these are the methods. This is really what the way of letting go is about. It's not the end. Patience, patience isn't something you attach to. It's something you practice, and through patient endurance, then there is non-grasping. So it's the method, metta karuna. It's the method. Upeka is the method. Self-sacrifice is the method. Gratitude is the method. And you start to put all those things together, then you see they're not qualities that one's trying to develop in some kind of ultimate way. I have to be grateful, or I have to be kind, or I have to be more patient. Those are ego imperatives. That's not really the way the practice works. But rather to say, oh yeah, if I'm patient with this very difficult state of consciousness, I know it as anicca dukkha anatta, that's the method. If I'm patient and receptive to a person who I'm finding irritating because of something they're saying, that's the method. That's the method of non-grasping. If I can be equanimous with this pain that I'm feeling in my legs, that's the method. If I can give up my own preferences and learn how to serve and learn how to take care of the community and the place around me, that's the method of going beyond selfishness. If I'm sitting in meditation and I see and I want to, like I'm in my kuti alone and I set my clock for an hour, and after 10 minutes I'm restless and I think, oh, I'll go and write a letter or something like that. No, I just know this is restlessness. I'll be patient with that. That patience is the method. And you let go of that and sit through the hour and develop the factors for non-grasping. So the baramis are the method. They're not an end in themselves. But they're very, very... they really point to the profound energy we have to put into our lives, to the the need for diligence and skill constantly, constantly, constantly. So to live this life well, to kind of contemplate the generosity of our lay friends and the support we have, and then to make a determination. Every fortnight we come together to make a determination, not only to live by the Vinaya, but also to remember our ordination vows, what do you call them, or declaration statements, that we take up the robe, we take up this training for the realization of Nibbana. And that's a constant. Like when we chant the Patimokkha, we don't really remember that specifically. We just acknowledge, oh, these are the rules, these are the rules that we should live by. And if we've gone outside, then we acknowledge, oh, I was careless here, I was careless there. I'll try to be more careful next time around. So there's that kind of acknowledgement. But deeper than that, why are we doing this? Why keep these rules? Why not have a bacon sandwich in the afternoon? Or whatever you have. Well, it's because the aspiration for Nibbana. So this is the method. The Vinaya is the method. It's a vehicle. It's a tradition that helps us to awaken. If we don't have that, then of course very easily we fall into Silabhata Paramasa. It's just a ritual form that we keep. And we might feel diligent in some kind of way, but the whole ethos of it is lost. To not have the rules, of course, then you put down the rules. So Venerable Yatiko puts down the training now, but his aspiration still must be the same. It's still the same, it's still the same aspiration, but now he needs to seek another livelihood, another way to live. And we all, of course, wish him well in that sort of difficult transformation from 22 years as a monastic to lay life. And it's not easy. When I had a friend, an Italian monk, this wrote, he had ordained at 19, and I think he was a monk for 18 years. Oh, was it difficult for him? Because he didn't even know really how to open a bank account. All the kind of normal things which a person from 20 to 40 learns, he had to kind of pick all that stuff up and learn it. So it's very, very difficult, and in all other manner. Because monastic life, when someone leaves the monastic life, it's more than divorce. Because when you leave monastic life, you lose your kind of close family, you lose your job, you lose your flat, you lose your car, everything. All of a sudden everything's gone. So it's the change from a long period of monastic life into lay life is quite, quite difficult. I can't imagine it. The first monk I met, Venerable Nyanasuchi, he disrobed after 5 years. And he went to stay, he was going to live near Naropa Institute, Colorado. He lived there 3 years. And he was living with a friend, and the friend said to him, well, I'm going to make potatoes. What kind of potatoes do you want? And he said, I don't care, because he had a monastic contentment with little. This is an indication how it worked for him. So he said, she said, what kind of potatoes do you want? And he said, I don't care. What kind of potatoes? Scallop potatoes. And so then he just made a determination to always, if she would ask, he would say, scallop potatoes. And so this went on for, I don't know how long. And one day, she made French fries. And his mind, because he was a meditator, said, as soon as his mind saw the French fries, he says, where's my scallop potatoes? Just the whole preference thing had conditioned his mind into greed, and that was just, a small thing, but a kind of interesting insight on that whole thing. He eventually came back as a monk. Oh, he ordained as a samaner, lived in Thailand, and then he died in the road. So quite often mostly monastics don't return to the robe, it's actually rare, but they become very, very good friends for most part, good friends and very, very good lay people, because they have a kind of gravitas about them that has been through the life of living this life, so they usually end up pretty good in pretty good circumstances. So we wish him well, and I shall leave that there.
Kanyayan dhamma gadaya sadhu karam dadamase.